longer than a year. All you have to do is extend your vow. Let me command you for a decade, for a score of years, and together, I think not, he says, cutting me off. After all, you know how dangerous it would be to have Oak sit in my place. He is only a year older than he was. He's not ready. And yet, in only a few months, you will have to order me to abdicate in favor of him, or make an arrangement that will require us to trust each other, rather than my trusting you without hope of being trusted in return. I am furious with myself for thinking he might agree to keeping things the way they are. He gives me his sweetest smile. Perhaps then, you could be my seneschal in earnest. I grit my teeth. Once, a position as grand as seneschal would have been beyond my wildest dreams. Now it seems a humiliation. Power is infectious. Power is greedy. Have a care, I tell him. I can make the months that remain go slowly indeed. His smile doesn't falter.
Any other commands?
He asks. I ought to tell him more about Orla, but the thought of his crowing over her offer is more than I can bear. I cannot let that marriage happen. And right now, I don't want to be teased about it. Don't drink yourself to death tomorrow, I say. And watch out for my sister.
Taryn seemed well enough tonight, he says. Roses in her cheeks and merriment on her lips.
Let's be sure she stays that way, I say. His brows rise.
Would you like me to seduce her away from Locke? I could certainly try. I promise nothing in the way of results, but you might find amusement in the attempt.
No. No, absolutely not. Do not do that, I say, and do not examine the hot spike of panic his words induce. I just mean, try to keep Locke from being his worst self when she's around. That's all. He narrows his eyes.
Shouldn't you encourage just the opposite?
Perhaps it would be better for Taryn to discover unhappiness with Locke as soon as possible. But she's my sister, and I never want to be the cause of her pain. I shake my head. He makes a vague gesture in the air.
As you wish. Your sister will be wrapped in satin and sackcloth, as protected from herself as I can make her.
I stand. The council wants Locke to arrange some amusement to please Grimson. If it's nice, perhaps the smith will make you a cup that never runs out of wine. Cardan gives me a look up through his lashes that I find hard to interpret, and then rises too. He takes my hand.
Nothing is sweeter,
he says, kissing the back of it,
but that which is scarce.
My skin flushes, hot and uncomfortable. When I go out, his little circle is in the hall, waiting to be allowed back into his rooms. My sister looks a bit queasy, but when she sees me, she pastes on a wide, fake smile. One of the boys has put a limerick to music, playing it again and again, faster and faster. Their laughter floods the hallway, sounding like the cawing of crows. Heading through the palace, I pass a chamber where a few courtiers have gathered. There, toasting an eel in the flames of a massive fireplace, sitting on a rug, is the old High King Eldred's court poet and seneschal, Val Morin. Fairy artists and musicians sit around him. Since the death of most of the royal family, he's found himself at the center of one of the court factions, the Circle of Larks. Brambles are coiled in his hair, and he sings softly to himself. He's mortal, like me. He's also probably mad. Come, drink with us, one of the larks says. But I demur.
Pretty, petty Jude.
The flames dance in Valmorin's eyes when he looks my way. He begins picking off burnt skin and eating the soft white flesh of the eel. Between bites, he speaks.
Why haven't you come to me for advice yet? It said that he was High King Eldred's lover once. He's been in the court since long before the time my sisters and I came here. Despite that, he never made common cause of our mortality. He never tried to help us. Never tried to reach out to us to make us feel less alone. Do you have some? He gazes at me and pops one of the eyes of the eel into his mouth. It sits, glistening on his tongue. Then he swallows.
Maybe, but it matters little.
I am so tired of riddles. Let me guess. Because when I ask you for advice, you're not going to give it to me. He laughs, a dry, hollow sound. I wonder how old he is. Under the brambles, he looks like a young man. But mortals won't grow old so long as they don't leave Elfheim. Although I cannot see age and lines on his face, I can see it in his eyes.
Oh, I will give you the finest advice anyone's ever given you.
But you will not heed it. Then what good are you? I demand, about to turn away. I don't have time for a few lines of useless doggerel for me to interpret.
I'm an excellent juggler, he says,
wiping his hands on his pants, leaving stains behind. He reaches into his pocket, coming up with a stone, 3 acorns, a piece of crystal, and what appears to be a wishbone.
Juggling, you see, is just tossing 2 things in the air at the same time.
He begins to toss the acorns back and forth, then adds the wishbone. A few of the larks nudge one another, whispering delightedly,
"No matter how many things you add, you've got only 2 hands, so you can only toss 2 things. You've just got to throw faster and faster, higher and higher."
He adds the stone and the crystal, the things flying between his hands fast enough that it's hard to see what he's tossing. I suck in a breath. Then everything falls, crashing to the stone floor. The crystal shatters. One of the acorns rolls close to the fire.
"My advice," says Valmorin, "is that you learn to juggle better than I did, Seneschal."
For a long moment, I am so angry that I can't move. I feel incandescent with it, betrayed by the one person who ought to understand how hard it is to be what we are here. Before I do something I will regret, I turn on my heels and walk away.
"I foretold you wouldn't take my advice," he calls after me.
Chapter 11. The evening of the Hunter's Moon. The whole court moves to the Milkwood, where the trees are shrouded in masses of silk coverings that look, to my mortal eyes, like nothing so much as the egg sacs of moths, or perhaps the wrapped-up suppers of spiders. Locke has had a structure of flat stones built up the way a wall might be, into the rough shape of a throne. A massive slab of rock serves for a back, with a wide stone for a seat. It towers over the grove. Cardan sits on it, crown gleaming at his brow. The nearby bonfire burns sage and yarrow. For a distorted moment, he seems larger than himself. Moved into myth, the true High King of Faerie, and no one's puppet.
Awe slows my step, panic following at my heels.
A king is a living symbol, a beating heart, a star upon which Elfheim's future is written. Surely you have noticed that since his reign began, the Isles are different. Storms come in faster. Colors are a bit more vivid. Smells are sharper. When he becomes drunk, his subjects become tipsy without knowing why. When his blood falls, things grow. I just hope he doesn't see any of this on my face. When I am in front of him, I bow my head, grateful for an excuse not to meet his eyes. "My king," I say. Cardan rises from the throne. unclasping a cape made entirely of gleaming black feathers. A new ring glimmers on his pinky finger, red stone catching the flames of the bonfire. A very familiar ring. My ring. I recall that he took my hand in his rooms. I grind my teeth, stealing a glance at my own bare hand. He stole my ring. He stole it, and I didn't notice. The roach taught him how to do that. I wonder if Nikasia would count that as a betrayal. It sure feels like one.
Walk with me,
he says, taking my hand and guiding me through the crowd. Hobbs and Griggs, green skin and brown, tattered wings and sculpted bark garments. All the folk of Elfheim have come out tonight in their finery. We pass a man in a coat stitched with golden leaves, and another in a green leather vest with a cap that curls up like a fern. Blankets cover the ground and are piled with trays of grapes the size of fists and ruby-bright cherries. What are we doing? I ask, as Cardin steers me to the edge of the woods.
I find it tedious to have my every conversation remarked on,
he says.
I want you to know your sister isn't here tonight. I made sure of it.
So what does Locke have planned? I ask, unwilling to be grateful and refusing to compliment him on his sleight of hand. He certainly staked his reputation on this evening. Cardin makes a face.
I don't worry my pretty head about that kind of thing. You're the ones who are supposed to be doing the work. Like the ant in the fable who labors in the dirt, while the grasshopper sings the summer away.
And has nothing left for winter, I say.
I need for nothing,
he says, shaking his head, mock mournful.
I am the Corn King, after all. To be sacrificed, so little oak can take my place in the spring.
Overhead, orbs have been lit and glow with warm, magical light as they drift through the night air, but his words send a shiver of dread through me. I look into his eyes. His hand slides to my hip, as though he might pull me closer. For a dizzy, stupid moment, something seems to shimmer in the air between us. Kiss me until I am sick of it. He doesn't try to kiss me, of course. He hasn't been shot at, isn't delirious with drink, isn't filled with enough self-loathing.
You ought not to be here tonight, little aunt,
he says, letting go of me.
Go back to the palace.
Then he is cutting back through the crowd. Courtiers bow as he passes. A few, the most brazen, catch hold of his coat, flirt, try to pull him into the dance. And he, who once ripped a boy's wing from his back because he wouldn't bow, now allows all this familiarity with a laugh. What has changed? Is he different because I have forced him to be? Is it because he is away from Bilkin? Or is he no different at all, and I am only seeing what I want to see? I still feel the warm pressure of his fingers against my skin. Something is really wrong with me, to want what I hate, to want someone who despises me, even if he wants me too. My only comfort is that he doesn't know what I feel. Whatever debauchery Locke has planned, I must stay to find the representative from the Court of Termites. The sooner my favor to their Lord Roybin is dismissed, the sooner I have one less debt hanging over my head. Besides, they can hardly offend me more than they have. Cardin makes it back to the throne as Nikasia arrives with Grimson, a moth pin holding his cloak. Grimson begins a speech that doubtlessly is flattering and produces something from a pocket. It looks like an earring, a single drop, which Cardin lifts to the light and admires. I guess he has made his first magical object in Elfheim's service. In the tree to the left of them, I see the hob-faced owl, Snapdragon, blinking down. Although I can't spot them, the ghost and several more spies are nearby, watching the revel from enough distance that if a move is made, they will be there.
A centaur-like musician with the body of a deer has come forward, one carrying a lyre carved in the shape of a pixie, her wings forming the top curve of the instrument. It is strung with what appears to be thread of many colors. The musician begins to play, the carving to sing. Nikasia saunters over to where the smith is sitting. She wears a dress of purple that is peacock blue when it catches the light. Her hair is woven into a braid that circles her head. And at her brow is a chain from which dangle dozens upon dozens of beads in sparkling purples and blues and amber. When Grimson turns toward her, his expression lightens. I frown. Jugglers begin tossing a series of objects, from live rats to shiny swords, into the air. Wine and honeyed cakes are passed around. Finally, I spot Dulcamera, from the court of termites, her red as poppy's hair bound up into coils, and a two-handed blade strapped across her back, a silver dress blowing around her. I walk over, trying not to seem intimidated. Welcome, I say. To what do we owe the honor of your visit? Has your king found something I could do? She cuts me off with a glance toward Cardin.
Lord Roybin wants you to know that even in the low courts, we hear things.
For a moment, my mind goes through an anxious inventory of all the things Dulcamera might have heard. Then I remember that the folk have been whispering that Cardin shot one of his lovers for his own amusement. The Court of Termites is one of the few courts to have both Seely and Unseely members. I'm not sure if they'd mind about the hurt courtier, or just the possibility of an unstable High King. Even without liars, there can still be lies, I say carefully. Whatever rumors you heard, I can explain what really happened.
Because I ought to believe you? I think not.
She smiles.
We can call in our marker any time we like, mortal girl. Lord Roybin may send me to you, for instance, to be your personal guard.
I wince. By guard, she obviously means spy.
Or perhaps we will borrow your smith, Grimson. He could make Lord Roybin a blade that cuts clean through vows.
I haven't forgotten my debt. Indeed, I hoped you would let me repay it now, I say, drawing myself up to my full authority.
But Lord Roybin shouldn't forget.
She cuts me off with a snarl.
See that you don't forget.
With that, she stalks off, leaving me to think of all the smarter things I should have said. I still owe a debt to the Court of Termites, and I still have no way to extend my power over Cardin. I still have no idea who might have betrayed me, or what to do about Nikasia. At least this revel does not seem particularly worse than any other, for all of Locke's braggadocio. I wonder if it might be possible for me to do what Terran wants and get him ousted as master of revels after all, just for being boring. As though Locke can read my thoughts, he claps his hands together, silencing the crowd. Music stutters to a stop, and with it, the dancing and juggling, even the laughter.
I have another amusement for you, he says. It is time to crown a monarch tonight, the Queen of Mirth.
One of the lutists plays a merry improvisation. There is scattered laughter from the audience. A chill goes through me. I have heard of the game, although I have never seen it played. It is simple enough. Steal away a mortal girl. Make her drunk on fairy wine, and fairy flattery, and fairy kisses. Then convince her she is being honored with a crown, all the time heaping insults on her oblivious head. If Locke has brought some mortal girl here to have fun at her expense, he will have me to reckon with. I will lash him to the black rocks of Innsweel for the mermaids to devour. Well, I am still thinking that, Locke says.
But surely, only a king can crown a queen. Cardan stands up from the throne, stepping down the stones to be beside Locke. His long feathered cape slithers after him.
So where is she?
The High King asks, brows raised. He doesn't seem amused, and I am hopeful he will end this before it begins. What possible satisfaction could he find in the game?
Haven't you guessed? There is only one mortal among our company,
Locke says.
Why, our Queen of Mirth is none other than Jude Duarte.
For a moment, my mind goes entirely blank. I cannot think. Then I see Locke's grin and the grinning faces of the folk of the court, and all my feelings curdle into dread.
Let's have a cheer for her, says Locke.
They cry out in their inhuman voices, and I have to choke down panic. I look over at Cardan and find something dangerous glittering in his eyes. I will get no sympathy there. Nikasia is smiling exultantly, and beside her, the smith Grimson, is clearly diverted. Dulcamera, at the edge of the woods, watches to see what I will do. I guess Locke has done something right at last. He promised the High King delights, and I am entirely sure that Cardan is thoroughly delighted. I could order him to stop whatever happens next. He knows it, too. Which means that he supposes I will hate what he's about to do, but not enough to command him and reveal all. Of course, there's a lot I would endure before I did that. You will regret this. I don't say the words, but I look at Cardan and think them with such force that it feels as though I am shouting. Locke gives a signal, and a group of imps comes forward carrying an ugly, tattered dress, along with a circle of branches. Affixed to the makeshift crown are foul little mushrooms, the kind that produce a putrid-smelling dust. I swear under my breath.
New raiment for our new queen,
Locke says. There is some scattered laughter and gasps of surprise. This is a cruel game, meant to be played on mortal girls when they're glamored, so they don't know they're being laughed at. That's the fun of it, their foolishness. They delight over dresses that appear like finery to them. They exult greedily over crowns, seeming to gleam with jewels. They swoon at the promise of true love. Thanks to Prince Dane's Gesh, fairy glamours do not work on me. But even if they did, every member of the court expects the High King's human seneschal to be wearing a charm of protection, a strand of rowan berries, a tiny bundle of oak, ash, and thorn twigs. They know I see the truth of what Locke is giving me. The court watches me with eager, indrawn breaths. I am sure they have never watched a Queen of Mirth who knew she was being mocked before. This is a new kind of game.
Tell us what you think of our lady,
Locke asks Cardan loudly, with a strange smile. The High King's expression stiffens, only to smooth out a moment later when he turns toward the court.
I have too often been troubled by my dreams of Jude,
he says, voice carrying.
Her face features prominently in my most frequent nightmare.
The courtiers laugh. Heat floods my face because he's telling them a secret, and using that secret to mock me. When Eldred was High King, his revels were stayed. But a new High King isn't just a renewal of the land, but of the court itself. I can tell he delights them with his caprices and his capacity for cruelty. I was a fool to be tempted into thinking he's any different than he's always been.
Some among us do not find mortals beautiful. In fact, some of you might swear that Jude is unlovely.
For a moment,
I wonder if he wants me to be furious enough to order him to stop and reveal our bargain to the court. But no, it's only that with my heart thundering in my head, I can barely think.
But I believe it is only that her beauty is unique.
Cardan pauses for more laughter from the crowd. Greater jeering.
Excruciating. Alarming. Distressing.
Perhaps she needs new raiment to bring out her true allure,
Locke says.
Greater finery for one so fine.
The imps move to pull the tattered, threadbare rag gown over my own, to the delight of the folk. More laughter. My whole body feels hot. Part of me wants to run away, but I am caught by the desire to show them I cannot be cowed. Wait, I say, pitching my voice loud enough to carry. The imps hesitate. Cardan's expression is unreadable. I reach down and catch hold of my hem, then pull the dress I am wearing over my head. It's a simple thing. No corset, no clasps, and it comes off just as simply. I stand in the middle of the party in my underwear, daring them to say something, daring Cardan to speak. Now I am ready to put on my new gown, I say. There are a few cheers, as though they don't understand the game is humiliation. Locke, surprisingly, appears delighted. Cardan steps close to me, his gaze devouring. I am not sure I can bear his cutting me down again. Luckily, he seems at a loss for words. I hate you, I whisper before he can speak. He tilts my face to his.
Say it again,
he says, as the imps comb my hair and place the ugly, stinking crown on my head. His voice is low. The words are for me alone. I pull out of his grip, but not before I see his expression. He looks as he did when he was forced to answer my questions, when he admitted his desire for me. He looks as though he's confessing. A flush goes through me, confusing because I am both furious and shamed. I turn my head.
Queen of Mirth, time for your first dance,
Locke tells me, pushing me toward the crowd. Clawed fingers close on my arms. Inhuman laughter rings in my ears as the music starts. When the dance begins anew, I am in it. My feet slap down on the dirt in time with the pounding rhythm of the drums. My heart speeds with the trill of a flute. I am spun around, passed hand to hand through the crowd, pushed and shoved, pinched and bruised. I try to pull against the compulsion of the music, try to break away from the dance, but I cannot. When I try to drag my feet, hands haul me along until the music catches me up again. Everything becomes a wild blur of sound and flying cloth, of shiny ink drop eyes and two sharp teeth. I am lost to it, out of my own control, as though I were a child again, as though I hadn't bargained with Dane and poisoned myself and stolen the throne. This is not glamour. I cannot stop myself from dancing, cannot stop my body from moving even as my terror grows. I will not stop. I will dance through the leather of my shoes. Dance until my feet are bloody. Dance until I collapse.
Cease playing!
I shout, as loudly as I can, panic giving my voice the edge of a scream.
As your Queen of Mirth, as the Seneschal of the High King, you will allow me to choose the dance.
The musicians pause. The footfalls of the dancers slow. It is only perhaps a moment's reprieve, but I wasn't sure I could get even that. I am shaking all over with fury and fear. and the strain of fighting my own body. I draw myself up, pretending with the rest of them that I am decked out in finery instead of rags. "Let's have a reel," I say, trying to imagine the way my stepmother, Oriana, would have spoken the words. For once, my voice comes out just the way I want, full of cool command. And I will dance it with my king, who has showered me with so many compliments and gifts tonight. The court watches me with their glistening, wet eyes. These are the words they might expect the Queen of Mirth to say, the ones I am sure countless mortals have spoken before, under different circumstances. I hope it unnerves them to know I am lying. After all, if the insult to me is pointing out that I am mortal, then this is my riposte. I live here too, and I know the rules. Perhaps I even know them better than you, since you were born into them. But I had to learn. Perhaps I know them better than you, because you have greater leeway to break them. "Will you dance with me?" I ask Cardin, sinking into a curtsy, acid in my voice. "For I find you every bit as beautiful as you find me." A hiss goes through the crowd. I have scored a point on Cardin, and the court is not sure how to feel about it. They like unfamiliar things, like surprises, but perhaps they are wondering if they will like this one. Still, they seem riveted by my little performance. Cardin's smile is unreadable.
"I'd be delighted,"
he says, as the musicians begin to play again. He sweeps me into his arms. We danced once before, at the coronation of Prince Dane, before the murdering began, before I took Cardin prisoner at knife point. I wonder if he is thinking of it when he spins me around the Milkwood. He might not be particularly practiced with a blade, but as he promised the hag's daughter, he's a skilled dancer. I let him steer me through steps I doubtlessly would have fumbled on my own. My heart is racing, and my skin is slicked with sweat. Papery moths fly above our heads, circling up as though tragically drawn to the light of the stars. "Whatever you do to me," I say, too angry to stay quiet, "I can do worse to you."
"Oh,"
he says, fingers tight on mine.
"Do not think I forget that for a moment."
"Then why?" I demand.
"You believe I planned your humiliation?"
He laughs.
"Me? That sounds like work."
"I don't care if you did or not," I tell him, too angry to make sense of my feelings. "I just care that you enjoyed it."
"And why shouldn't I delight to see you squirm?" "You tricked me,"
Cardin says.
"You played me for a fool. And now I am the king of fools."
"The high king of fools," I say, a sneer in my voice. Our gazes meet, and there's a shock of mutual understanding that our bodies are pressed too closely. I am conscious of my skin, of the sweat beating on my lip, of the slide of my thighs against each other. I am aware of the warmth of his neck beneath my twined fingers, of the prickly brush of his hair, and how I want to sink my hands into it. I inhale the scent of him, moss and oak wood and leather. I stare at his treacherous mouth and imagine it on me. Everything about this is wrong. Around us, the revel is resuming. Some of the court glance our way, because some of the court always look to the High King. But Locke's game is at an end. "Go back to the palace," Cardin said, and I ignored the warning. I think of Locke's expression while Cardin spoke, the eagerness in his face,
It wasn't me he was watching. I wonder for the first time if my humiliation was incidental, the bait to his hook. Tell us what you think of Our Lady. To my immense relief, at the end of the reel, the musicians pause again, looking to the High King for instructions. I pull away from him.
I am overcome, Your Majesty. I would like your permission to withdraw.
For a moment, I wonder what I will do if Cardin denies me permission. I have issued many commands, but none about sparing my feelings.
You are free to depart or stay, as you like,
Cardin says magnanimously.
The Queen of Mirth is welcome wheresoever she goes.
I turn away from him and stumble out of the revel, to lean against a tree, sucking in breaths of cool sea air. My cheeks are hot. My face is burning. At the edge of the Milkwood, I watch waves beating against the black rocks. After a moment, I notice shapes on the sand, as though shadows were moving on their own. I blink again. Not shadows. Selkies. Rising from the sea. A score, at least. They cast off their sleek sealskins and raise silver blades. The undersea has come to the hunter's moon revel. Chapter 12. I rush back, tearing the long gown on thorns and briars in my haste. I go immediately to the nearest member of the guard. He looks startled when I run up, out of breath, still clad in the rags of the Queen of Mirth.
The undersea, I manage. Selkies, they're coming. Protect the king.
He doesn't hesitate, doesn't doubt me. He calls together his knights and moves to flank the throne. Cardin looks at their movement in confusion, and then, with a brief, bright spark of panic. No doubt he is recalling how Matic ordered the circling of the guards around the dais at Prince Dane's coronation ceremony, just before Bailkin started murdering people. Before I can explain, out of the Milkwood step the Selkies, their sleek bodies bare except for long ropes of seaweed and pearls around their throats. The playing of instruments ceases. Laughter gutters out. Reaching to my thigh, I take out the long knife holstered there.
What is this?
Cardin demands, standing. A female Selkie bows and steps to one side. Behind them come the gentry of the undersea, walking on legs I am not sure they possessed an hour before. They sweep through the grove in soaking wet gowns and doublets and hose, seeming not at all discomfited. They look ferocious, even in their finery. My eyes search the crowd for Nikasia, but neither she nor the smith are there. Locke sits on one of the arms of the throne, looking for all the world as though he takes for granted that if Cardin is High King, then being High King cannot be so special.
Your Majesty, says a gray-skinned man in a coat that appears to be made from the skin of a shark. He has a strange voice, one that seems hoarse with disuse.
Orla, Queen of the Undersea, sends us with a message for the High King. Grant us permission to speak.
The half-circle of knights around Cardin tightens. Cardin does not immediately answer. Instead, he sits.
The Undersea is welcome at this Hunter's Moon revel. Dance. Drink. Never let it be said that we are not generous hosts, even to uninvited guests.
The man kneels, but his expression is not at all humble.
Your munificence is great, and yet we may not partake of it until Our Lady's message is delivered. You must hear us. Must I? Very well,
the High King says after a moment. He makes an airy gesture.
What has she to say?
The gray-skinned man beckons a girl in a wet blue dress, her hair up in braids. When she opens her mouth, I see that her teeth are thin, viciously pointed, and oddly translucent.
She intones the words in a sing-song. The sea needs a bridegroom. The land needs a bride. Cleave together, lest you face the rising tide. Spurn the sea once. We will have your blood. Spurn the sea twice. We will have your clay. Spurn the sea thrice. Your crown will away. The gathered folk of the land, courtiers and petitioners, servants and gentry, grow wide-eyed at the words.
Is that a proposal?
Locke asks. I think he means to speak so that only Cardan hears him. But in the silence, his voice carries.
A threat, I'm afraid.
Cardan returns. He glares at the girl, at the gray-skinned man, at everyone.
You've delivered your message. I have no bit of doggerel to send back. My own fault for having a seneschal who cannot double as my court poet. But I will be sure to crumple up some paper and drop it into the water when I do.
For a moment, everyone stays as they were, exactly in their places. Cardan claps his hands, startling the sea folk.
Well?
He shouts.
Dance! Make merry! Isn't that what you came for?
His voice rings with authority. He no longer just looks like the High King of Elfheim. He sounds like the High King. A shiver of premonition goes through me. The undersea courtiers, in their sodden garments and gleaming pearls, watch him with pale, cold eyes. Their faces are unexpressive, enough that I cannot tell if his shouting upset them. But when the music begins again, they take one another's webbed hands and sweep away into the revel, to leap and cavort as though this was something they did for pleasure themselves beneath the waves. My spies have remained hidden through this encounter. Locke melts away from the throne to whirl with two mostly naked selkies. Nicasia remains nowhere to be seen, and when I look for Dulcamera, I cannot spot her either. Dressed as I am, I cannot bear to speak with anyone in an official capacity. I tear the stinking crown from my head and toss it into the grass. I think about shimmying out of the tattered gown, but before I can decide to actually do it, Cardan waves me over to the throne. I do not bow. Tonight, after all, I am a ruler in my own right, the Queen of Mirth, who is not laughing.
I thought you were leaving,
he snaps. And I thought the Queen of Mirth was welcome wheresoever she goes. I hiss back.
Assemble the Living Council in my rooms in the palace,
he tells me, voice cold and remote and royal.
I will join you as soon as I can get away.
I nod, and am halfway through the crowd, when I realize two things. One, he gave me an order. And two, I obeyed it. Once at the palace, I send out pages to summon the council. I send Snapdragon with a message for my spies to discover where Nicasia has gone. I would have thought that she'd make herself available to hear Cardan's answer, but given that she was uncertain enough about Cardan's feelings to shoot a rival lover, maybe she's reluctant to hear it. Even if she believes he'd choose her over a war, that's not saying much. In my rooms, I strip off my clothes quickly and wash myself. I want to be rid of the perfume of the mushrooms, the stink of the fire, and the humiliation. It feels like a blessing to have my old clothing there. I tug on a dull brown dress, too simple for my current position, but comforting all the same. I pull back my hair with ruthless severity. Tatterfell is no longer around, but it's obvious she's been by. My rooms are tidy, my things pressed and hung. And sitting on my desk, a note addressed to me, from the Grand General of the High King's Army to His Majesty's Seneschal. I rip it open. The note is shorter than what is written on the envelope. Come to the war room immediately,
Do not wait for the council. My heart thuds dully. I consider pretending I didn't get the message and simply not going. But that would be cowardice. If Maddox still has hopes of scheming Oak onto the throne, he can't let a marriage to the Undersea happen. He has no reason to know that, in this at least. I am entirely on his side. This is a good opportunity to get him to show his hand. And so, I head reluctantly to his war room. It's familiar. I played here as a child, under a large wooden table covered in a map of Faerie, with little carved figures to represent its courts and armies. His dolls, as Vivi used to call them. When I let myself in, I find it dimly lit. Candles burn low on a desk beside a few stiff chairs. I recall reading a book curled up in one of those chairs while beside me violent plots were hatched. Looking up from the very same chair, Maddox rises and gestures for me to sit opposite him, as though we are equals. He is being interestingly careful with me. On the strategy board, there are only a few figures. Orla and Cardin, Maddox, and a figure I do not recognize until I study it more carefully. It is myself I am looking at, rendered in carved wood. Seneschal, spy master, kingmaker. I am abruptly afraid of what I have done to make it onto that board. I got your note, I tell him, settling into a chair.
After tonight, I thought you might be finally reconsidering some of the choices you made, he says.
I begin to speak, but he holds up a clawed hand to stop my words.
Were I you,
he goes on,
my pride might lead me to pretend otherwise. The folk cannot tell lies, as you know. Not with our tongues, but we can deceive. And we are as capable of self-deceit as any mortal.
I am stung by his knowing I was crowned Queen of Mirth, and laughed at by the court. You don't think I know what I'm doing?
Well,
he says carefully,
not for certain. What I see is you're humiliating yourself with the youngest and most foolish of princes. Did he promise you something?
I bite the inside of my cheek to keep from snapping at him. No matter how low I already feel, if he thinks me a fool, then a fool I must allow myself to be. I am seneschal to the High King, am I not? It's just hard to dissemble with the laughter of the court still ringing in my ears, with the foul dust of those mushrooms still in my hair, and the memory of Cardin's obnoxious words. Excruciating, alarming, distressing. Maddox sighs and spreads his hands in front of him.
Do you know why Eldred had no interest in his youngest son? Baefin saw ill fortune in his stars from the moment of his birth. Yet so long as Cardin wears the blood crown, I am sworn to him as surely as I was to his father. As surely as I would have been to Dane, or even Baelkin. The opportunity that presented itself at the coronation. The opportunity to change the course of destiny is lost to me.
He pauses. However he phrases it, the meaning is the same. The opportunity was lost because I stole it from him. I am the reason Oak is not the High King, and Maddox isn't using his influence to remake Elfheim in his image.
But you,
Maddox says,
who are not bound by your words, whose promises can be forsworn.
I think of what he said to me after the last Living Council meeting, as we walked. No oath binds you. If you regret your move, make another. There are games yet to play. I see he has chosen this moment to expand upon his theme. You want me to betray Cardin, I say, just to make things clear. He stands and beckons me to the strategy table.
I don't know what knowledge you have of the Queen of the Undersea from her daughter. But once, the Undersea was a place much like the land. It had many fiefdoms, with many rulers, among the Selkies and Merfolk. When Orla came into power, she hunted down each of the smaller rulers and murdered them, so the whole Undersea would answer only to her. There are yet a few rulers of the sea she hasn't brought beneath her thumb. A few too powerful, and a few more too remote. But if she marries her daughter to Cardan, you can be sure she will push Nicasia to do the same on land.
Murder the head of the smaller courts? I ask. He smiles.
Of all the courts. Perhaps at first it will seem like a series of accidents, or a few foolish orders, or maybe it will be another bloodbath.
I study him carefully. After all, the last bloodbath was at least partially his doing. And you disagree with Orla's philosophy? Would you have done much the same were you the power behind the throne?
I wouldn't have done it on behalf of the sea,
he says.
She means to have the land as her vassal.
He reaches for the table and picks up a small figurine, one carved to represent Queen Orla.
She believes in the forced peace of absolute rule.
I look at the board.
You wanted to impress me,
he says.
You guessed, rightly, that I would not see your true potential. Until you bested me. Consider me impressed, Jude. But it would be better for both of us to stop fighting each other and focus on our common interest. Power.
That hangs in the air ominously. A compliment delivered in the form of a threat. He goes on.
But now, come back to my side. Come back. Before I move against you in earnest.
What does coming back look like? I ask. He gives me an evaluating stare, as though wondering just how much to say out loud.
I have a plan. When the time comes, you can help me implement it.
A plan I didn't help make, and that you won't tell me much about? I ask. What if I'm more interested in the power I already have? He smiles, showing his teeth.
Then I guess I don't know my daughter very well. Because the Jude I knew would cut out that boy's heart for what he did to you tonight.
At the shame of having the revel thrown in my face, I snap. You let me be humiliated and fairy from the time I was a child. You've let folk hurt me and laugh at me and mutilate me. I hold up the hand with the missing fingertip, where one of his own guards bit it clean off. Another scar is at its center, from where Dane forced me to stick a dagger through my hand. I've been glamored and carried into a revel, weeping and alone. As far as I can tell, the only difference between tonight and all the other nights when I endured indignities without complaint is that those benefited you. And when I endure this, it benefits me. Maddock looks shaken.
I didn't know.
You didn't want to know, I return. He turns his gaze to the board, to the pieces on it, to the little figurine that represents me.
That argument's a fine strike, right at my liver. But I am not so sure it does well as a parry. The boy is unworthy.
He would have kept on talking, but the door opens and Randolin is there, peering in, his robes of state looking hastily tugged on.
Oh, both of you. Good. The meeting is about to begin. Make haste.
As I start to follow, Maddock grabs my arm.
His voice is pitched low. You tried to tell us that this was going to happen. All I ask from you tonight is that you use your power as Seneschal to block any alliance with the Undersea.
Yes, I say.
thinking of Nikasia and Oak and all my plans. That, I can guarantee.
Chapter 13. The Living Council gathers in the High King's enormous chambers, around a table inlaid with the symbol of the Greenbrier line. Flowers and thorns with coiling roots. Nior, Randolin, Bafin, and Mikkel are seated, while Fala stands in the middle of the floor, singing a little song.
Fishies, fishies, putting on their feet. Marry a fish and life will be sweet. Fry her in a pan and pick out her bones. Fishy blood is cold, top a throne.
Cardin throws himself on a nearby couch with dramatic flair, disdaining the table entirely.
This is ridiculous. Where is Nikasia?
We must discuss this offer, says Randolin.
Offer?
Scoffs Matic, taking a seat.
The way it was delivered. I am not sure how he could marry the girl without seeming as though the land feared the sea and capitulated to its demands.
Perhaps it was a trifle heavy-handed, says Nior.
Time for us to prepare,
Matic says.
If it's war she wants, it is war we will give her. I will pull the salt from the sea before I let Elfheim tremble over Orla's wrath.
War. Exactly what I feared Matic would rush us into. And yet now it arrives without his instigation.
Well,
says Cardin, closing his eyes as though he is going to nap right there.
No need for me to do a thing, then.
Matic's lip curls. Randolin looks slightly discomposed. For so long, he wanted Cardin at meetings of the Living Council, but now he isn't quite sure what to do with his actual presence.
You could take Nikasia as your consort instead of your bride, says Randolin. Get an heir on her fit to rule over land and sea.
Now I am not to marry at Orla's command, only breed,
Cardin demands.
I want to hear from Jude,
Matic says, to my enormous surprise. The rest of the council turns toward me. They seem utterly baffled by Matic's words. In meetings, my only value has been as a conduit between themselves and the High King. Now, with his representing himself, I might as well be one of the little wooden figures on a strategy board for all they expect me to speak.
Whatever for? Randolin wants to know.
Because we didn't heed her before. She told us that the Queen of the Undersea was going to move against the land. Had we attended her, we might not now be scrambling for strategy.
Randolin winces.
That's true enough, says Nior,
as though she is trying to think of a way to explain away this troubling sign of competence.
Perhaps she will tell us what else she knows,
Matic says. Mikhail's eyebrows rise.
Is there more?
Bafin asks.
Jude?
Prompts Matic. I weigh my next words. As I said, Orla has been communicating with Baelkin. I don't know what information he's passed on to her, but the sea sends folk to the land with gifts and messages for him. Cardin looks surprised and clearly unhappy. I realize that I neglected to tell him about Baelkin and the Undersea, despite informing the council.
Did you know about Nikasia as well?
He asks. I begin foundering.
She likes to keep her own counsel on the council,
Bafin says with a sly look. As though it's my fault none of them listens to me. Randolin glowers.
You never explained how you learned any of this.
If you're asking whether I have secrets, I could easily ask the same of you, I remind him. Previously, you weren't interested in any of mine.
Prince of the land, prince under the waves,
says Fala.
Prince of prisons, prince of knaves. Baelkin's no strategist,
Matic says. which is as close to admitting he was behind Eldred's execution as he's ever done.
He's ambitious, though. And proud. Spurn the sea once. We will have your blood,
says Cardan.
That's oak, I imagine.